Gildan Audio presents Your Coach in a Box, affordable life-changing seminars on CD. The First 90 Days. Critical Success Strategies for New Leaders at All Levels by Michael Watkins.
Introduction, the first 90 days. The President of the United States gets 100 days to prove himself. You get 90. The actions you take during your first 3 months in a new job will largely determine whether you succeed or fail. Transitions are periods of opportunity, a chance to start afresh and to make needed changes in an organization. But they are also periods of acute vulnerability, because you lack established working relationships and a detailed understanding of your new role. If you fail to build momentum during your transition, you will face an uphill battle from that point forward. The stakes are obviously high. Failure in a new assignment can spell the end of a promising career. But making a successful transition is about more than just avoiding failure. Some leaders do derail, and when they do, their problems can almost always be traced to vicious cycles that developed in the first few months on the job. But for every leader who fails outright, there are many others who survive, but do not realize their full potential. As a result, they lose opportunities to advance in their careers, and they endanger the health of their organizations. This book is therefore as much about transition acceleration as it is about failure prevention. It provides a blueprint for dramatically condensing the time it will take you to get on top of the job, regardless of your level in your organization. If you succeed in this, you will free up time to concentrate on fixing problems and exploiting opportunities in your new organization. After all, your goal should be to arrive as rapidly as possible at the break-even point, where you are a net contributor of value to your new organization. Every minute you save by being systematic about accelerating your transition is a minute you gain to build the business. The break-even point. The break-even point is the point at which new leaders have contributed as much value to their new organizations as they have consumed from it. New leaders are net consumers of value early on. As they learn and begin to take action, they begin to create value. From the break-even point onward, they are, one hopes, net contributors of value to their organizations. When 210 company CEOs and presidents were asked for their best estimates of the time it takes a typical mid-level manager in their organizations to reach the break-even point, the average of their responses was 6.2 months. The purpose of transition acceleration, then, is to help new leaders reach the break-even point earlier. What would it be worth to an organization if all its leaders in transition could reach the break-even point 1 month earlier? Given the stakes, it is surprising how little good guidance is available to new leaders about how to transition more effectively and efficiently into new roles. There are plenty of books and articles on leadership, but few directly address transitions at all. Also, excellent resources on managing organizational change exist, but most implicitly assume the change agent is already settled in the organization, with the necessary knowledge and relationships in place to plan, build support for, and carry out transformational initiatives. The reality is that the process of leading change often occurs in tandem with the leader's transition into a new role. This book is therefore intended to fill a gap in the leadership literature. It offers a proven blueprint for addressing the linked challenges of personal transition and organizational transformation that confront leaders in their first few months in a new job. Fundamental propositions. From observing new leaders and experimenting with methods of accelerating transitions, I have developed strong beliefs about the challenges of transitions and what it takes to succeed in meeting them. These beliefs, summarized in 5 propositions, form the foundation of my approach to transition acceleration and to this book. The first proposition is that the root causes of transition failure always lie in a pernicious interaction between the situation, with its opportunities and pitfalls, and the individual, with his or her strengths and vulnerabilities. Failure is never just about the flaws of the new leader. Indeed, the failed leaders whom I studied had all achieved significant successes in the past. Nor is it ever just about a no-win situation in which not even a superhuman leader could have carried the day. The business situations facing leaders who derail are no tougher than those in which others succeed brilliantly. Transition failures happen when new leaders either misunderstand the essential demands of the situation or lack the skill and flexibility to adapt to them. The second proposition is that there are systematic methods that leaders can employ to both lessen the likelihood of failure and reach the break-even point faster. Early in my efforts to develop a framework for accelerating transition at all levels, an experienced manager told me, "You can't do that." When I asked why, he said, "Because every transition is unique." That is true, of course. It is also misleading. Sure, every transition is unique if you look at its details. But viewed from a higher vantage point, we can discern types of transitions that share common features, including common traps. Consider, for example, making a transition from functional vice president to general manager. Every leader who makes this leap encounters similar challenges, such as the need to let go of reliance on functional expertise. The transition from frontline supervisor to manager of managers represents a similar challenge at a lower level. The specific business situations that confront transitioning leaders also vary. But specific types of transition situations, such as startups and turnarounds, share certain features and imperatives. Further, there are fundamental principles, for example, securing early wins, that underpin success in transitions at all levels, whether one is a new supervisor or a new CEO. The key, then, is to match your strategy to the situation. This is a core theme to which we will return throughout the book. The third proposition is that the overriding goal in a transition is to build momentum by creating virtuous cycles that build credibility and by avoiding getting caught in vicious cycles that damage credibility. Leadership is about leverage. The new leader is, after all, just one person. To be successful, she will have to mobilize the energy of many others in her organization. Her vision, her expertise, her drive can serve as a seed crystal in the new organization, one that will grow exponentially into new and more productive patterns of behavior. Too often, however, the new leader behaves more like a virus. Her early actions alienate potential supporters, undermine her credibility, and stimulate defensive reactions. As a vicious cycle takes hold, the organization's immune system gets activated and the new leader is attacked by clumps of killer cells, encapsulated, and finally expelled. The fourth proposition is that transitions are a crucible for leadership development and should be managed accordingly. Precisely because they strengthen diagnostic skills, demand growth and adaptation, and test personal stamina, transitions are an indispensable development experience for every company's high-potential leaders. A survey conducted as part of McKinsey's War for Talent study asked a sample of 200 senior executives to identify their five most important developmental experiences. The top overall responses all involved significant transitions into new roles. New position with large scope, turning around a business, starting a new business, large high-profile special projects, or working outside the home country. This proposition emphatically does not mean, as it does at too many companies, throwing good people into the deep end to see if they sink or swim. Like swimming, transitioning is a teachable skill. Transition acceleration skills should be taught to people who are in transition, so that talented people do not drown unnecessarily. My fifth and final proposition is that adoption of a standard framework for accelerating transitions can yield big returns for organizations. Each year, over 500,000 managers enter new positions in Fortune 500 companies alone. Given the frequency with which people take on new jobs and the impact of each transition on others in the organization, it helps a lot if everyone, bosses, direct reports, and peers, speak the same transition language. Why shouldn't every person who is getting to know a new boss employ a shared set of guidelines, such as those provided in Chapter 5 of this book, to build that critical relationship? Also, adopting standard approaches to learning about a new organization, securing early wins, and building coalitions translates into speedier organizational adjustments to the unavoidable stream of personnel shifts and environmental changes. Adopting a rational framework for transitional acceleration translates into real bottom-line impact. Accelerating organizations. The final proposition deserves some extra emphasis and explanation. As you listen to what follows, think about the implications not just for you, but also for your organization. Each year, slightly fewer than a quarter of the managers in a typical Fortune 500 company change jobs. That means that managers spend an average of 4 years in a given position. High potential leaders in the mid-senior ranks have shorter average time in position. Their eras typically last 2.5 to 3 years. Their careers consist of a series of such eras, punctuated by transition periods of a few months during which their actions set the tone for what follows and strongly influence their overall performance. Companies need to move their best people through positions of increasing responsibility to develop them. If they do not do so, they risk losing their best talent to competitors. But the constant churn comes at a cost. Each new manager takes time to reach the break-even point, and the pace of business is such that there is little time available to get acclimated and little latitude for poor early decisions. For each individual who transitions, there are also many others, direct report, bosses, and peers, whose performance is negatively affected. In a survey of company presidents and CEOs, I asked for their best estimate of the number of people whose performance was significantly compromised by the arrival of a new mid-level manager. The average of the responses was 12.4 people. In effect, all the people in the impact network of the transitioning manager are in transition too. A further challenge is transitioning talented people into the organization from the outside. Even healthy organizations need to do this to introduce new ideas and preserve vitality. However, the failure rate for new leaders who enter organizations from the outside is high. Studies have found that no more than 40 to 50% of senior outside hires fail to achieve desired results. Estimates of the direct and indirect cost to a company of a failed executive-level hire range as high as $2.7 million. When surveyed, senior HR practitioners assess the challenge of coming in from the outside as much harder than being promoted from within. They attribute the high failure rate of outside hires to several barriers to making a successful transition, notably the following. Executives from outside the company are not as familiar with the organizational structure and the existence of informal networks of information and communication. Outside hires are not familiar with the corporate culture and therefore have greater difficulty assimilating. New people are unknown to the organization and therefore do not have the same credibility as someone who is promoted from within. A long tradition of hiring from within makes it difficult for organizations to adjust to senior-level managers who are viewed as outsiders. When a new leader fails, it is a severe, perhaps career-ending blow to the individual. But every leadership failure, whether an outright derailment or a less dramatic underperformance, is costly for the organization as well. Success in accelerating the transition of all managers, at every level and whether they are being promoted from within or hired from outside, could represent a tremendous gain in performance for the organization. It is surprising, therefore, that few companies pay much attention to accelerating leadership transitions. When I lead transition acceleration programs, I ask the new leaders in the room to write down the number of transitions they have made so far in their careers and the number they anticipate making before they retire. In a group of 30, the responses to both questions typically total more than 150 transitions. Then I ask how many participants have received training or coaching from their organization in how to make transitions, and the answer is essentially none. All these talented people had to develop their own models for how to make transitions. This is hard-won knowledge, and the failure to share it represents a big loss for the organization. This valuable cache of experience is seldom converted into organizational learning. Also, people develop their own idiosyncratic approaches to taking charge, approaches that may or may not continue to serve them well as they rise in an organization or switch to a new one. A shared framework for transition acceleration is therefore an organizational asset. In addition to reducing the costs of disruption, a common approach to managing leadership transitions can help you identify and retain the best leadership talent. We don't identify star swimmers by throwing children into the pool unprepared. We teach them to swim, coach them, and then let performance speak for itself. Transition acceleration also is a skill that can be taught. Leaders should not succeed just because they happen to have mentors who are good swim coaches or because they get placed into situations that happen to play to their strengths. Neither should promising people fail because they lack these advantages. If you truly want a managerial meritocracy, then you should level the playing field during transitions. Success strategies for new leaders. Why is so little good advice available about accelerating transitions? In part, the answer is because there are many different kinds of transitions. Thus, it is not enough to come up with general rules or one-size-fits-all advice. Consider the following pairs of transition situations. How do the definitions of success and the imperatives for making effective transitions differ in these cases? Promotion to a more senior role in marketing versus moving from marketing to a position as general manager of a business unit. Moving to a new position within your existing organization versus moving to a new company. Moving from a staff position to line management versus moving from line to staff. Taking over a group facing very serious problems versus taking over a group widely and accurately viewed as very successful. The point? The challenges of transition acceleration vary depending upon situational factors. It matters a great deal whether you are making a key career passage in terms of level in the organization, whether you are an insider or an outsider, whether you have formal authority, and whether you are taking over a successful or a troubled group. Thus, it is essential that you match your strategy to the situation you face. Practical advice has to be tailored to the situation, the level of the new leader, his or her experience with the organization, and the condition of the business. That is the fundamental goal of this book, to provide new leaders with practical frameworks for diagnosing their situations and developing their own customized transition acceleration plans. To illustrate the power of a systematic approach to transition acceleration, consider the challenge a new leader faces in diagnosing his new organization's business situation. How does he characterize the challenges and opportunities? How does he reach consensus with his new boss and direct reports about what actions need to be taken? Without a conceptual framework to guide diagnosis and planning, this turns out to be a lot of work. It is also easy to blunder into dangerous misunderstandings with bosses or direct reports about what needs doing. Even if the new leader achieves the necessary shared understanding, he is likely to have consumed significant time and energy in the process and might have missed some important opportunities and failed to identify some ticking time bombs. Now suppose instead that the new leader is counseled to figure out early on whether his new job is a startup, turnaround, realignment, or a sustaining success situation. Suppose, too, that he has clear descriptions of the challenges and opportunities typical of each of these situations and actionable guidelines for establishing priorities in each one. What changes? This diagnostic tool, called the STARS model for startup, turnaround, realignment, and sustaining success, is developed in detail in Chapter 3. It powerfully accelerates the new leader's diagnosis of his new organization and his development of effective action plans. It also helps the new leader to more rapidly reach a shared understanding of the situation with other key players, including his boss and direct reports. Whether he is taking over an entire organization or managing a group or a short-term project, he can use this tool to accelerate his transition. So take heart. There are structural similarities in challenges and opportunities, and corresponding guidelines, must-dos and don't-dos, for different types of transitional situations. The key is to engage in careful diagnosis and then adapt some general principles to the demands of the situation. Plan of the audiobook. The rest of the audio program provides a roadmap for creating your 90-day acceleration plan. The conceptual backbone of the roadmap is 10 key transition challenges. Number 1. Promote yourself. This doesn't mean hiring your own publicist. It means making the mental break from your old job and preparing to take charge in the new one. Perhaps the biggest pitfall you face is assuming that what has made you successful to this point in your career will continue to do so. The dangers of sticking with what you know, working extremely hard at doing it, and failing miserably are very real. Number 2. Accelerate your learning. You need to climb the learning curve as fast as you can in your new organization. This means understanding its markets, products, technologies, systems, and structures, as well as its culture and politics. Getting acquainted with a new organization can feel like drinking from a fire hose. You have to be systematic and focused about deciding what you need to learn and how you will learn it most efficiently. Number 3. Match strategy to situation. There are no universal rules for success in transitions. You need to diagnose the business situation accurately and clarify its challenges and opportunities. Startups, for instance, of a new product, process, plant, or a completely new business share challenges quite different from those you would face while turning around a product, process, or plant in serious trouble. A clear diagnosis of the situation is an essential prerequisite for developing your action plan. Number 4. Secure early wins. Early wins build your credibility and create momentum. They create virtuous cycles that leverage the energy you are putting into the organization to create a pervasive sense that good things are happening. In the first few weeks, you need to identify opportunities to build personal credibility. In the first 90 days, you need to identify ways to create value, improve business results, and get to the break-even point more rapidly. Number 5. Negotiate success. Because no other single relationship is more important, you need to figure out how to build a productive working relationship with your new boss and manage his or her expectations. This means carefully planning for a series of critical conversations about the situation, expectations, style, resources, and your personal development. Crucially, it means developing and gaining consensus on your 90-day plan. Number 6. Achieve alignment. The higher you rise in an organization, the more you have to play the role of organizational architect. This means figuring out whether the organization's strategy is sound, bringing its structure into alignment with its strategy, and developing the systems and skill bases necessary to realize strategic intent. Number 7. Build your team. If you are inheriting a team, you will need to evaluate its members and perhaps restructure it to better meet the demands of the situation. Your willingness to make tough early personnel calls and your capacity to select the right people for the right positions are among the most important drivers of success during your transition. You will need to be both systematic and strategic in approaching the team-building challenge. Number 8. Create coalitions. Your success will depend on your ability to influence people outside your direct line of control. Supportive alliances, both internal and external, will be necessary to achieve your goals. You should therefore start right away to identify those whose support is essential for your success and to figure out how to line them up on your side. Number 9. Keep your balance. In the personal and professional tumult of a transition, you will have to work hard to maintain your equilibrium and preserve your ability to make good judgments. The risks of losing perspective, getting isolated, and making bad calls are ever present during transitions. There is much you can do to accelerate your personal transition and to gain more control over your work environment. The right advice and counsel network is an indispensable resource. Number 10. Expedite everyone. Finally, you need to help everyone in your organization, direct reports, bosses, and peers, accelerate their own transitions. The quicker you can get your new direct reports up to speed, the more you will help your own performance. Beyond that, the benefits to the organization of systematically accelerating everyone's transitions are potentially vast. If you succeed in meeting these core challenges, you will have a successful transition. Failure to surmount any one of them, however, is enough to cause potentially crippling problems. The chapters that follow offer actionable guidelines and tools for succeeding in meeting each of these 10 challenges. You will learn how to diagnose your situation and create action plans tailored to your needs, regardless of your level in the organization or the business situation you face. In the process, you will build a 90-day plan that will accelerate you into your new role. This audiobook is for new leaders at all levels, from first-time managers to CEOs. The fundamental principles of effective transition acceleration hold up well across all levels, but the specifics of who, what, when, and how, and the relative weights of the 10 key challenges vary a lot. For more senior people, aligning the architecture of the organization, building the team, and creating coalitions loom large. For less senior people, building a relationship with the new boss and creating a supportive advice and counsel network will be priorities. Every new leader needs to quickly become familiar with the new organization to secure early wins and to build supportive coalitions. That's why this audiobook provides guidelines for translating principles into plans tailored to your own situation. As you continue through it, you should listen closely, making notes about the applicability of specific points to your situation, as well as thinking about how the advice should be customized to your situation. Chapter 1. Promoting Yourself. After 8 years in marketing at a Texas-based consumer electronics company, Julia Gould was promoted to her first project leader position. Up to that point, her track record had been stellar. Her intelligence, focus, and determination had won her recognition and early promotion to increasingly senior positions. The company had designated her a high-potential leader and had positioned her on the fast track to more senior leadership. Julia was assigned to be the launch manager for one of the company's hottest new products. It was her responsibility to coordinate the work of a cross-functional team drawn from marketing, sales, R&D, and manufacturing. The goal? To seamlessly move the product from R&D to production, oversee a rapid ramp-up, and streamline the market introduction. Julia ran into trouble early on. Her success in marketing was due to her extraordinary attention to detail. Accustomed to managing with authority and making the calls, she had a high need for control and a tendency to micromanage. When she tried to continue making the calls, members of the team initially said nothing. But soon, two key members challenged her knowledge and authority. Stung, she focused more on the area she knew best, the marketing aspects of the launch. Her efforts to micromanage the marketing members of the team alienated them. Within a month and a half, Julia was back in marketing and someone else was leading the team. Julia Gould failed because she was unable to make the leap from being a strong functional performer to taking on a cross-functional project management role. She failed to grasp that the strengths that had made her successful in marketing could be liabilities in a role that required her to lead without direct authority or superior expertise. She kept doing what she knew how to do, which made her feel confident and in control. The result, of course, was the opposite. By not letting go of the past and fully embracing her new role, she squandered a big opportunity to rise in the organization. What might Julia Gould have done differently? She should have focused on mentally promoting herself into the new position, a fundamental challenge for new leaders. Promoting yourself does not mean self-serving grandstanding or hiring a PR firm. It means preparing yourself mentally to move into your new role by letting go of the past and embracing the imperatives of the new situation to give yourself a running start. This can be hard work, but it is essential that you do it. All too often, promising managers get promoted but fail to promote themselves by undertaking the necessary change in perspective. A related mistake is to believe that you will be successful in your new job by continuing to do what you did in your previous job, only more so. They put me in the job because of my skills and accomplishment, the reasoning goes, so that must be what they expect me to do here. This thinking is destructive because doing what you know how to do and avoiding what you don't can appear to work, at least for a while. You can exist in a state of denial, believing that because you are being productive and efficient, you are being effective. You may keep on believing this until the moment the walls come crashing down around you. No one is immune to this trap, not even accomplished senior executives. Consider the experience of Douglas Ivester at Coca-Cola. Ivester was promoted to CEO in 1997 after the sudden death of his predecessor, the highly praised Roberto Gozita, who had led Coke since 1981. In 1999, after a string of missteps that had eroded the confidence of Coke's board of directors, Ivester resigned. To outside observers, Ivester had appeared to be the perfect candidate for the job. "The real challenge for Coca-Cola," wrote one PaineWebber analyst, quote, "is not to become a casualty of their own success. And I think with the current lineup at Coke, starting with Doug Ivester, they're not too likely to become complacent," unquote. Fortune dubbed him the, quote, "prototype boss for the 21st century," unquote. An accountant by training, Ivester had spent nearly 20 years rising through the ranks to become Coke's COO and Gozita's right-hand man. Named Coke's CFO in 1985, at age 37, he quickly made his mark by orchestrating the successful 1986 spinoff of the company's bottling operations, Coca-Cola Enterprises. He also succeeded as president of European operations, his first operating role, and oversaw the company's expansion into Eastern Europe in 1989. Ivester was named president of Coke USA 1 year later and became president and COO of the company in 1994. But Ivester was unable to make the leap from COO to CEO. He refused to name a new COO, even when strongly pressed to do so by Coke's board of directors. Instead, he continued to act as super COO and maintained daily contact with the 16 people who reported to him. His extraordinary attention to detail, which had been such a virtue in finance and operations, proved to be a hindrance in this new position. Ivester could not free himself from day-to-day operations enough to take on the strategic, visionary, and statesmanlike roles of an effective CEO. The result was a series of missteps, none fatal on its own, that cumulatively sapped Ivester's credibility. His ham-handed treatment of European regulators contributed to Coke's failure to acquire Orangina in France and drastically reduced the value of its acquisition of Cadbury Schweppes brands. He was also widely seen as having mishandled a crisis in 1999 involving contamination of Coke bottled in Belgium by not visibly taking charge. He alienated other potential allies by failing to respond effectively to a festering racial discrimination suit in Coke's Atlanta headquarters and by applying too much pressure to Coke's already stretched bottlers regarding concentrate pricing and inventories. By the end, Ivester had few friends. Suggesting that Ivester's failure was the result of a fatal character flaw, the Wall Street Journal mused, quote, "The job of running a giant company like Coca-Cola Company is akin to conducting an orchestra, but M. Douglas Ivester, it seems, had a tin ear. He knew the math, but not the music required to run the world's leading marketing organization," unquote. The root causes of Ivester's failure, however, lay less in what he could not do or learn to do than in what he could not let go of. An impressive career came to a deeply disappointing, even tragic conclusion, because he persisted in concentrating on what he felt most competent doing. Was his failure inevitable? Probably not. Was it likely given his approach to the transition from COO to CEO? Absolutely. Promoting yourself. How can you avoid this trap? How can you be sure to embrace the challenges of your new position? This section provides some basic principles for mentally getting ready for your new position. Establish a clear breakpoint. The move from one position to another usually happens in a blur. You rarely get much notice before being thrust into a new job. A lucky new leader gets a couple of weeks, but more often the move is measured in days. You get caught up in a scramble to finish in your old job, even as you try to wrap your arms around the new one. Even worse, you may be pressured to perform both jobs until your previous position is filled, making the line of demarcation even fuzzier. Because you may not get a clean transition in terms of job responsibilities, it is essential to discipline yourself to make the transition mentally. Pick a specific time, such as a weekend, and use it to imagine yourself being promoted. Consciously think of letting go of the old job and embracing the new one. Think hard about the differences between the two and in what ways you have to think and act differently. Take the time to celebrate your move, even informally, with family and friends. Use the time to touch base with your informal advisors and counselors and to ask for some quick advice. The bottom line? Do whatever it takes to get into the transition state of mind. Hit the ground running. Your transition begins the moment you learn you are being considered for a new job. It ends roughly 90 days after you begin the job. By this point, key people in the organization, your bosses, peers, and direct reports, expect you to be getting some traction. A 3-month time frame is not a hard and fast rule. It depends on what type of situation you're entering. Regardless, you should use the 90-day mark as a key milestone for planning purposes. It will help you confront the need to operate in a compressed time frame. If you are lucky, you may get a month or more of lead time between learning you're being considered and sitting in the chair. Use that time to begin educating yourself about your organization. Regardless of how much preparation time you get, start planning on what you hope to accomplish by specific milestones. You probably won't have much time, but even a few hours of pre-entry planning go a long way. Begin by thinking about your first day on the new job. What do you want to do by the end of that day? Then move to the first week. Then focus on the end of the first month, the second month, and finally the 3-month mark. These plans will be sketchy, but the simple act of beginning to plan will help clear your head. Assess your vulnerabilities. You have been offered your new position because those who hired you think you have the skills to succeed. You probably do. But as we saw in the cases of Julia Gould and Douglas Ivester, it can be fatal to rely too much on what made you successful in the past. As one senior executive expressed it, everyone has an urge to work at one level below where they are. You need to work where you are, not where you were. One way to pinpoint your vulnerabilities is to assess your problem preferences, the kind of problems towards which you naturally gravitate. Everyone likes to do some things more than others. Julia Gould's preference was marketing. For Douglas Ivester, it was finance and operations. Your preferences have probably influenced you to choose jobs where you can do more of what you like to do. As a result, you perfect those skills and feel most competent when you solve problems in those areas, which reinforces the cycle. This pattern is like exercising your right arm and ignoring your left. The strong arm gets stronger and the weak one atrophies. The risk, of course, is that you create an imbalance that leaves you vulnerable in situations in which success depends on being ambidextrous. Table 1-1, which is in the PDF document in the final CD of this program, is a simple tool for assessing your preferences for different kinds of business problems. Fill in each cell by assessing your intrinsic interest in solving problems in the domain in question. In the first cell, for example, ask yourself how much you like to work on appraisal and reward systems. This isn't a comparative question. Don't compare this interest with others. Rank your interest in each type of problem separately on a scale of 1, not at all, to 10, very much. Keep in mind that you are being asked about your intrinsic interests, not your skills or experience. Now transfer your rankings from Table 1-1 to the corresponding cells in Table 1-2, also found in the PDF document on the final CD of this program. Then, sum the three columns and the five rows. The column totals represent your preferences among technical, political, and cultural problems. Technical problems encompass strategies, markets, technologies, and processes. Political problems concern power and politics in the organization. Cultural problems involve values, norms, and guiding assumptions. If one column total is noticeably lower than the others, it represents a potential blind spot for you. If you score high on technical and low on cultural or political, for example, you may be at risk of overlooking the human side of the organizational equation. The row totals represent your preferences for different business functions. A low score in any row suggests that you prefer not to grapple with problems in that functional area. Again, these are potential blind spots. The results of this diagnostic exercise should help you answer the following questions. In what spheres do you most enjoy solving problems? In what spheres are you least eager to solve problems? What are the implications for potential vulnerabilities in your new position? You can do a lot to compensate for your vulnerabilities. Three basic tools are self-discipline, team building, and advice and counsel. You will need to discipline yourself to devote time to critical activities that you do not enjoy and that may not come naturally. Beyond that, actively search out people in your organization whose skills are sharp in these areas so they can backstop you and so you can learn from them. A network of advisors and counselors can also help you move beyond your comfort zone. These strategies for compensating for your weaknesses are discussed in detail in Chapter 7, Build Your Team, and Chapter 9, Keep Your Balance. Watch out for your strengths. Your weaknesses can make you vulnerable, but so can your strengths. Every strength has its attendant pitfalls. The qualities that have made you successful so far can prove to be weaknesses in your new role. Both Julia Gould and Douglas Ivester were attentive to detail. Though clearly a strength, attention to detail has a downside, especially in tandem with a high need for control. The result may be a tendency to micromanage people in the areas you know best. This behavior pattern can demoralize people who want to make their own contributions without intrusive oversight. Relearn how to learn. It may have been a long time since you faced such a steep learning curve. Suddenly I realized how much I didn't know is a common lament from leaders in transition. You may have excelled in a function or discipline like Julia Gould, and now you find yourself in a general management position. Or, having flourished in line positions, you may have been called on to manage in a staff position or a matrix management arrangement. Or you may be joining a new company where you lack an established network and sense of the culture. Regardless, you suddenly need to learn a lot fast. Having to start learning again can evoke long-buried and unnerving feelings of incompetence and vulnerability, especially if you suffer any early setbacks. You may find yourself mentally revisiting a juncture in your career when you had less confidence. Perhaps you will make some early missteps and experience failure for the first time in ages. So you unconsciously begin to gravitate towards areas where you feel competent and people who reinforce your feelings of self-worth. New challenges and associated fears of incompetence can set up a vicious cycle of denial and defensiveness. As Chris Argyris noted in Teaching Smart People How to Learn in the Harvard Business Review, because many professionals are almost always successful at what they do, they rarely experience failure. And because they have rarely failed, they have never learned how to learn from failure. So whenever their learning strategies go wrong, they become defensive, screen out criticism, and put the blame on anyone and everyone but themselves. In short, their ability to learn shuts down precisely at the moment they need it the most. Put bluntly, you can decide to learn or you can become brittle and fail. Your failure may be dramatic, like Julia Gould's, or it may be death by a thousand cuts, as in the case of Douglas Ivester, but it is inevitable. As we discuss in the next chapter, denial and defensiveness are a sure recipe for disaster. Relearning to learn can be painful. Transitioning into a new job may revive some deep fears about your capabilities that you thought you had long laid to rest. So if you find yourself waking up in a cold sweat, take comfort. Most new leaders experience the same feelings, and if you embrace the need to learn, you can surmount them. Rework your network. As you advance in your career, the advice and counsel you need changes. Promoting yourself calls for working proactively to restructure your advice and counsel network. Early in your career, there is a premium on cultivating good technical advisors, experts in certain aspects of marketing or finance, for instance, who can help you get your work done. As you are progressively promoted, however, it becomes increasingly important to get good political counsel and personal advice. Political counselors help you understand the politics of the organization, which is especially important when you plan to implement change. Personal advisors help you keep perspective and equilibrium in times of stress. As discussed in Chapter 9, transforming your advice and counsel network is never easy. Your current advisors may be close friends, and you may feel comfortable with technical advisors whose domains you know well. Watch out for people who want to hold you back. Consciously or not, some individuals may not want you to advance. Your old boss may not want to let you go, for example. So you have to negotiate clear expectations, as soon as you know when you will be transitioning, about what you will do to close things out. This means being specific about what issues or projects will be dealt with, and to what extent and, critically, what is not going to be done. Take notes and circulate them back to the boss so that everyone is on the same page. Then hold your boss and yourself to the agreement. Be realistic about what you can accomplish. There is always more that you could do, so keep in mind that time to learn and plan before you enter a new job is a very precious commodity. Friends may not want their relationships with you to change, but change they must, and the sooner you accept that and help others to accept it too, the better. Others in your organization will be looking for signs of favoritism and will judge you accordingly. If you have been promoted to supervise people who were once your peers, some may be jealous. Some may even work to undermine you. This may subside with time, but expect early tests of your authority and plan to meet them by being firm and fair. If you don't establish limits early, you will live to regret it. Getting others to accept your promotion is an essential part of promoting yourself. So if you conclude the people in question are never going to accept the situation, then you have to find a way to move them out of your organization as quickly as possible. Overcoming the barriers. Promoting yourself turns out to be hard work, and some of the barriers may lie within you. Take a few minutes to think hard about your personal vulnerabilities in your new position, as revealed by your analysis of your problem preferences. How will you compensate for them? Then think about the external forces, such as commitments to your current boss, that could hold you back. How can you avoid that outcome? To borrow an old saw, promoting yourself is a journey and not a destination. You will have to work constantly to ensure that you are engaging with the real challenges of your new position and not practicing what Ron Heifetz terms work avoidance. It is easy to backslide into habits that are both comfortable and dangerous. Plan to listen again to this chapter and its questions periodically, asking, "Am I doing all that I can to promote myself?" An acceleration checklist. Lists like this one will be read at the end of each chapter to help you crystallize the key lessons and apply them to your situation. Use these questions to guide your analysis and tailor your 90-day acceleration plan. Number 1. What has made you successful so far in your career? Can you succeed in your new position by relying solely on those strengths? If not, what are the critical skills you need to develop? Number 2. Are there aspects of your new job that are critical to success, but that you prefer not to focus on? Why is that the case? How will you compensate for your potential blind spots? Number 3. What do you need to do to ensure that you make the mental leap into the new position? From whom might you seek advice and counsel on this? What other activities might help you to do this? Chapter 2. accelerate your learning. Chris Bagley headed the quality function at Sigma Corporation, a medium-sized durable goods company. When Chris's boss left to become vice president of manufacturing at White Goods, a struggling manufacturer of appliances, he offered Chris a job as general manager of its largest plant. Chris jumped at the opportunity. Sigma had built a strong manufacturing organization. Chris had joined the company right out of engineering school and rotated through most of the major manufacturing functions. He was highly skilled. However, he had grown accustomed to dealing with state-of-the-art technology and a motivated workforce. He had toured the White Goods plant before taking the job and knew that it did not come close to measuring up. He was determined to change that, and quickly. Soon after arriving at the plant, Chris declared it outdated and went on record as saying that it needed to be rebuilt from the ground up the Sigma way. He immediately brought in high-powered operations consultants. The consultants delivered a scathing report, characterizing the plant's technology and systems as antiquated and the workforce's skills as marginal. They recommended a thorough team-based reorganization of the plant, as well as substantial investments in technology and worker training. Chris shared this report with his direct reports, saying that he planned to act quickly on the recommendations. He interpreted their silence as agreement. Soon after the new team structure was put in place in one of the plant's four production lines, productivity plummeted and quality suffered. Chris convened his team and urged them to get the problems fixed and fast. But the problems remained and worker morale throughout the plant slumped. After 3 months, Chris's boss told him, "You've alienated just about everyone. I brought you here to improve the plant, not tear it down." His boss then peppered him with questions. "How much time did you spend learning about this plant? Did you know they already had experimented unsuccessfully with team production? Have you seen what they were able to accomplish before you arrived with the resources they were given? You've got to stop doing and start listening." Shaken, Chris held sobering discussions with his managers, supervisors, and groups of workers. He learned a lot about the creativity they had displayed in dealing with lack of investment in the plant. He then called a plant-wide meeting and praised the workforce for doing so much before he took charge. He announced the reorganization was on hold and that they would focus on upgrading the plant's technology before making any other changes. What did Chris do wrong? Like too many new leaders, he failed to learn enough about his new organization and so made some costly assumptions. It is essential to figure out what you need to know about your new organization and then to learn it as rapidly as you can. Why? Because efficient and effective learning reduces your window of vulnerability. You can identify potential problems that might erupt and take you off track. It also equips you to begin to make good business decisions earlier. Remember, your internal and external customers won't wait for you to take a leisurely stroll up the learning curve. Overcoming learning disabilities. When a new leader derails, failure to learn is almost always a factor. Information overload can obscure the most telling issues. There is so much to absorb that it is difficult to know where to focus. Amid the torrent of information coming your way, it is easy to miss important signals. Or you might focus too much on the technical side of the business, products, customers, technologies, and strategies, and shortchange the critical learning about culture and politics. To compound this problem, surprisingly few managers have received any training in systematically diagnosing an organization. Those who have had such training invariably prove to be either human resource professionals or former management consultants. A related problem is failure to plan to learn. Planning to learn means figuring out in advance what the important questions are and how you can best answer them. Few new leaders take the time to think systematically about their learning priorities. Fewer still explicitly create a learning plan when entering a new role. Some leaders even have learning disabilities, potentially crippling internal blocks to learning. One is a simple failure even to try to understand the history of the organization. A baseline question that every new leader should ask is, how did we get to this point? Otherwise, you risk tearing down fences without knowing why they were put up. Armed with insight into the history, you may indeed find the fence is not needed and must go, or you may find there is a good reason to leave it where it is. Other new leaders suffer from the action imperative, a learning disability whose primary symptom is a near-compulsive need to take action. If you habitually find yourself too anxious or too busy to devote time to systematic learning, you may suffer from this malady. It is a serious affliction because being too busy to learn often results in a death spiral. If you do not learn, you can easily make poor early decisions that undermine your credibility, making people less likely to share important information with you, leading to more bad decisions. The result is a vicious cycle that can irreparably damage your credibility. So beware. It may feel right to enter a new situation and begin acting decisively, and sometimes, as we will see in the next chapter, it is the right thing to do, but you risk being poorly prepared to see the real problems. Perhaps most destructive of all, some new leaders arrive with the answer. They have already made up their minds about how to solve the organization's problems. Having matured in an organization where things were done the right way, they fail to realize that what works well in one organizational culture may fail miserably in another. As Chris Bagley found out the hard way, this stance leaves you vulnerable to serious mistakes and is likely to alienate people. Bagley thought he could simply import what he had learned at Sigma to fix the plant's problems. Even in situations, such as turnarounds, in which you have been brought in explicitly to import new ways of doing things, you still have to learn about the organization's culture and politics to customize your approach. Besides, displaying a genuine ability to listen often translates into increased credibility and influence. Managing learning as an investment process. If you approach your efforts to get up to speed as an investment process, and your scarce time and energy as resources that deserve careful management, you will realize returns in the form of actionable insights. An actionable insight is knowledge that enables you to make better transitions earlier and so helps you reach the break-even point in terms of personal value creation sooner. Chris Bagley would have acted differently if he had known that, number one, senior management at White Goods had systematically underinvested in the plant, despite energetic efforts by local managers to upgrade. Number two, the plant had achieved remarkable results in quality and productivity given what they had to work with. And, number three, the supervisors and workforce were justifiably proud of what they had accomplished. To maximize your return on investment in learning, you have to effectively and efficiently extract actionable insights from the mass of information available to you. Effective learning calls for figuring out what you need to learn so that you can focus your efforts. Devote some time to defining your learning agenda as early as possible, and return to it periodically to refine and supplement it. Efficient learning means identifying the best available sources of insight and then figuring out how to extract maximum insight with the least possible outlay of your precious time. Chris Bagley's approach to learning about the White Goods plant was neither effective nor efficient. Defining your learning agenda. If Chris Bagley had it to do over, what might he have done? He would have planned to engage in a systematic learning process, creating a virtuous cycle of information gathering, analyzing, hypothesizing, and testing. The starting point is to begin to define your learning agenda, ideally before you even formally enter the organization. A learning agenda crystallizes your learning priorities. What do you most need to learn? It consists of a focused set of questions to guide your inquiry, or hypotheses that you want to explore and test, or both. Of course, learning during a transition is iterative. At first, your learning agenda will consist mostly of questions, but as you learn more, you will hypothesize about what is going on and why. Increasingly, your learning will shift towards fleshing out and testing those hypotheses. How should you compile your early list of guiding questions? Start by generating questions about the past, questions about the present, and questions about the future. Why are things done the way they are? Are the reasons why something was done, for example, to meet a competitive threat, still valid today? Are conditions changing such that something different should be done in the future? The following examples offer sample questions in these three categories. Questions about the past. Performance. How has this organization performed in the past? How do people in the organization think it has performed? How were goals set? Were they insufficiently or overly ambitious? Were internal or external benchmarks used? What measures were employed? What behaviors did they encourage and discourage? What happened if goals were not met? Root causes. If performance has been good, why has that been the case? What have been the relative contributions of the organization's strategy, its structure, its technical capabilities, its culture, and its politics? If performance has been poor, why has that been the case? Do the primary issues reside in the organization's strategy, its structure, its technical capabilities, its culture, its politics? History of change. What efforts have been made to change the organization? What happened? Who has been instrumental in shaping this organization? Questions about the present. Vision and strategy. What is the stated vision and strategy of the organization? Is it really pursuing that strategy? If not, why not? If so, is the strategy going to take the organization where it needs to go? People. Who is capable and who is not? Who can be trusted and who cannot? Who has influence and why? Processes. What are the key processes of the organization? Are they performing acceptably in terms of quality, reliability, and timeliness? If not, why not? Landmines. What lurking surprises could detonate and push you off track? What potentially damaging cultural or political missteps must you avoid making? Early wins. In what areas, people, relationships, processes, or products, can you achieve some early wins? Questions about the future. Challenges and opportunities. In what areas is the business most likely to face stiff challenges in the coming year? What can be done now to prepare for them? What are the most promising unexploited opportunities? And what would need to happen to realize their potential? Barriers and resources. What are the most formidable barriers to making needed changes? Are they technical, cultural, political? Are there islands of excellence or other high-quality resources that you can leverage? What new capabilities need to be developed or acquired? Culture. Which elements of the culture should be preserved, and which elements need to change? Identifying the best sources of insight. You will learn from various types of hard data, such as financial and operating reports, strategic and functional plans, employee surveys, press accounts, and industry reports. But to make effective decisions, you also need soft information about the organization's strategy, technical capabilities, culture, and politics. The only way to gain this intelligence is to talk to people who have critical knowledge about your situation. Who can provide the best return on your learning investment? Identifying promising sources will make your learning process both more complete and more efficient. Keep in mind that you need to listen to key people both inside and outside the organization. See Figure 2-1, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program. Talking to people with different points of view will deepen your insight. Specifically, this will enable you to translate between external realities and internal perceptions, and between the top of the hierarchy and the people on the front lines. The most valuable external sources of information are likely to be the following. Customers. How do customers perceive your organization? How do your best customers assess your products or services? How about your customer service? How do they rank your company against your competitors? Distributors. From distributors, you can learn about the logistics of product movement, customer service, and competitors' practices and offerings. You can also get a sense of the distributor's own capabilities. Suppliers. Suppliers can give you their perspectives on your organization in its role as a customer. You can also learn about the strengths and flaws of internal operations management and systems. Outside analysts. Analysts can give you a fairly objective assessment of your company's strategy and capabilities, as well as those of your competitors. Analysts also have a broad overview of the demands of the market and the economic health of the industry. Indispensable internal information sources are the following. Frontline R&D and operations. These are the people who develop and manufacture your products or deliver your services. Frontline people can familiarize you with the organization's basic processes and its relationships with key external constituencies. They can also shed light on how the rest of the organization supports or undermines efforts on the front line. Sales and purchasing. These people and customer service representatives and purchasing staff interact directly with customers, distributors, and suppliers. Often they have up-to-date information about trends and imminent changes in the market. Staff. talk with heads or key staff members of the finance, legal, and human resources functional areas. These people have specialized but useful perspectives on the internal workings of the organization. Integrators. Integrators are people who coordinate or facilitate cross-functional interaction, including project managers, plant managers, and product managers. You can learn from them how links within the organization work and how the functions mesh. These people can help you discover the true political hierarchies and identify where internal conflicts lie. Natural historians. Keep an eye out for old-timers or natural historians, people who've been with the company for a long time and those who naturally absorb the organization's history. From this group, you can learn about the company's mythology and the roots of its culture and politics.